Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. How are you today, Mom?
I'm good. It's a beautiful day here, and so I'm enjoying that.
It is. It's the end of summer.
Uh-huh. Yep, the end of summer.
Looking forward to fall, not winter quite so much.
Right. Well, I don't know. Winter comes and goes, you know, but there's a lot of months that are not winter, so we're good.
Okay. All right. Do you want to tell our listeners today who we are going to be talking to?
Well, today we are going to be talking to an author of a very interesting book and a very timely book. And the author is Vanessa Waugh, and she is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of a short story collection, Deceit and Other Possibilities. For two decades, she has been writing about Asia and the, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, diaspora. I'm not sure what that is, but we'll ask her, in journalism and in fiction. She received the Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award, the Asian Pacific Award in Literature, and many other things. She, her work has appeared in New York Times, The Atlantic, Frontline World, The Washington Post, and elsewhere. And she writes a weekly column for the San Francisco Chronicle, lives in Northern California. Very interesting book, I must say. I'm just...
And the title of this novel is A River of Stars.
A River of Stars, yeah. And I wondered all through the book, I'm going, why is it called that? And the last page, I found out. I'm not going to spoil the surprise. But
welcome to Writers' Voices, Vanessa.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Great. So is this your first novel?
Yes, A River of Stars is my debut novel. My other book is a short story collection.
And your background is in journalism.
Yes. Well, I began writing short stories ever since I was a kid writing fiction. My professional career after I graduated from college was in journalism before I returned to fiction.
Wow. And what made you decide to take that turn?
I remember, looking at some stories I'd written in college and thinking, these aren't bad, but do I remember how to do that? And so much of my identity had been around being a fiction writer. So I returned by starting to go to writing groups and writing conferences, writing in the morning before work and at lunch. But it wasn't until I was on this journalism reporting trip to South Korea and I was talking to another journalist and I said, oh, you know, I've always wanted to write a novel. And she looked at me and said, well, then write one. And, she was just making conversation, I suppose, but it really resonated with me that I needed to make that goal, closer to the center of my life. If I was saying that was something I always wanted to do, I had to go about doing it and trying to make that happen.
So did you quit your day job? Did you write on weekends?
Yeah, the writing, I mean, being a newspaper journalist is very demanding and all-consuming, the sort of thing where you're always getting calls at dinner and working on weekends and vacations getting canceled. So for me, writing a book was not something I could do on the side. And so I was able to, I applied to get my Master's of Fine Arts and got into UC Riverside, which has an excellent program. They also are, it was fully funded, so I didn't have to pay for any of it. And so it seemed like a great place to have the time and guidance in which to work on a book-length project. Not everyone, there's an ongoing debate. People often ask, like, do I need an MFA? And there are many different routes to writing and publishing a book. But for me, that was the path I took.
Well, it sounds like it really was for to be able to focus on this, that was a
right.
Very
although,
good path.
Although what I worked on in grad school was not this book. That's what I worked on in grad school is actually going to be my next book. But I mean, it's just a long and winding road in terms of, you know, developing as a writer. You know, the collection came out. I, you know, still was freelancing as a journalist. And I also, in that time, you know, had kids. So many life changes. And so you have to sort of manage your writing life around everything else.
Well, this book, of course, is very, the subject matter is very timely and important for all of us to know these things, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, we hear, you know, you hear this and you hear that, but I'm assuming that you're actually writing something that's real and pertinent and things we should know. Am I right?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think right now the country is so divided and often immigrants and the children of immigrants are under attack. And what happens is they're, you know, reduced either to stereotype or statistic. And so we just don't know about individual stories. We're not hearing them. And when you take away someone's story, you take away their humanity. So in my journalism and in my fiction, I've always tried to shine a light onto untold stories. And, you know, so we might better understand someone's dreams, motivations, histories, and, you know, to understand what motivates their actions and, you know, to reflect the world that we live in.
Right. Well, you mentioned in your acknowledgement section a place called Writer's Grotto. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. Every chance I get, I shout it out. You know, it's a workspace in San Francisco founded a little over 2 decades ago. And, you know, there's offices and writing carols and, you know, people come in to write. And also we teach classes there. And it's just a wonderful community because, obviously to finish a book, it's solitary. It's only you sitting at your desk with your notebook or at the computer. But the times in which you can find community are really sweet. And, you know, you can commiserate, you can talk through like a narrative dilemma, a publishing dilemma. And then when it comes time for a book to come out or a movie to come out or, you know, some other wonderful fruit of our labors, then it's a chance to celebrate with this community that backs you, that, you know, shows up at your readings. I like to say we roll deep at the San Francisco Writer's Grotto. So, and I think it's a sort of spirit that you can see happening in other writing communities, you know, around the country. And I think, you know, people often ask, like, oh, I wish there was a Writer's Grotto where I lived. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, well, start one yourself, you know, make so much about writing community is often about sort of like putting yourself out there, you know, doing a podcast, hosting a reading, going to readings. And the more you put yourself out there, I've found, you get 10 or 100 times back in terms of like just benefit of, you know, what you put out in the universe comes back to you.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually a great idea to for people to start them. It doesn't take much, really.
Right. It's just about, you know, well, I mean, you know, depending on how you want to model it, if you, you know, decide that you, it could be something as, for example, there's groups called Women Who Submit, and they just decide, I think, every month or every quarter to meet in a cafe of their choosing, and everyone shows up, and, you know, in that hour, they sort of decide, oh, okay, we're going to submit to all those literary magazines or magazines that we put off pitching to, and we're going to do that right now.
Oh.
So it's a, yeah, so... you know, the grotto, it has a physical space. So, you know, there's kind of more, you know, it's a little more complicated in terms
right.
of keeping that going, but the spirit is there. The spirit of community can kind of be kindled and carried on wherever you live. I mean, it could even be online, right? Like you can find that support
sure,
that way.
Sure. You know, Vanessa, you used the word, writing carols, and mm-hmm. I hadn't heard that word in a long time. And for anyone who's not familiar with it, it's like a little desk with side, so they're, the desks are side by side, and but they have dividers between them. And it just flashed back to study carrels in, or library carrels. And I just have some really, really positive connotation with that, and I'm not even sure why.
Well, probably like myself, you might have some very fond memories of studying or being in the library, right?
Yes.
And so what's so wonderful at the grotto is, you know, you get into your carrel or go into your office. You put in, for me, I'll put in my headphones and I get to work. And you kind of look over and you see other people sort of getting to work, and you seeing each other sort of like motivating, like, is extremely rewarding, because it's sort of like, okay, they're going at it, I'm going to go at it. And, you know, and what can feel like sometimes, you know, foolish or pointless or like, what am I doing? you see that other people are engaged also in this practice of art making, and that it does matter, and it should matter.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Vanessa Hua, author of A River of Stars. Now, this book is about an immigrant from China who is sent here by her lover to give birth to their, what they think, supposed son, in the U.S. so that he will have U.S. citizenship. Is this something that happens frequently?
I mean, it happens. I don't know if it's in huge numbers, but maybe it will help to explain how I first heard about it and got inspired to write the book. I was pregnant and living in Southern California at the time, and I began hearing about what was termed like maternity hotels or birth tourism hotels. What it is, you know, suburban homes, you know, east of Los Angeles, pregnant Chinese women were coming and going. The alleyways, the garbage cans were like piled high with diapers, and the neighbors were completely baffled. They wondered what is going on. And to me, it sounded like a brothel in reverse to have all these pregnant women coming. And it turned out, yeah, there was sort of a underground industry, you know, sort of in hide, yet also hiding in plain sight, where you could go to their website, you could book, you know, a room, standard, luxury, and, you know, sort of accommodating women who were willing to make the trip here. And I think what fascinated me, or what really moved me, was, you know, for me, or being pregnant is one of the most vulnerable times in a woman's life. And so what was it, you know, why would they were willing to be far from friends and family? Like, what was it about U.S. citizenship? What did it mean to them for their children, to want to have that for children, their children, so that they would come here? And I mean, since I've written the novel, I've heard that it happens like sort of on a de facto basis, like with people with some means who can come here. I mean, sometimes it's also a matter of wanting to access, you know, paying for and accessing the you know, higher standards of healthcare. I heard Russian mothers, you know, do it in Miami. But I'll be clear, it's not huge, like it's not a flood of people, but it certainly exists and continues to exist.
Let me ask you this. Would it be harder for a pregnant woman to obtain a visa, because the authorities would think that the reason she was traveling was because she wanted her child to be born in the United States?
Right. Well, I mean, they're all coming in on tourist visas. So whatever way that they, you know, the sort of requirements that often come in that are attached to visas, like having a bank account and, you know, a pledge to return, all that, you know, that's still all in place. But yeah, like you, from what I read in news reports, you know, women would come and sort of bag your clothes. And, you know, they would maybe like take a detour to the Grand Canyon or Vegas before making their way onward to, you know, to the U.S. So I don't, they're not necessarily, you know, when at the visa, the border controls, they're not telling like, oh, I'm here to give birth to a baby. They're saying like, I'm you know, if anything, it's a lie of omission. Yeah.
I see.
So they try and hide it because otherwise they might be suspect.
Right, right. But you're not supposed to be traveling anyway on airplanes after 36 week, right?
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So let me ask you about China's one child policy still in effect?
It's been gradually relaxed, and I can talk a bit about the history briefly. So it was founded, put into place in 1979 to curb the birth rate and in the hope of spurring economic development. And it was, enforced in sort of a very draconian fashion, like forced abortions, forced sterilizations. And, in my novel, Scarlett is an only child, as many are of her generation, and her mother works at a family planning clinic because she's a widow, and sort of that's the best way she can, take care of her and her daughter. But, Scarlett ends up, after witnessing sort of what her mother has done to be an enforcer, it makes her, ambivalent about having kids, makes her, she leaves home as a teenager to find work in the factories because she wants a life different than her mother's. So she's, fully been shaped by that policy. The Chinese government said in 2015, which is actually after the events in the novel take place. Anyway, the Chinese government said, okay, actually you can have two children. And now, even more recently, there's talk of incentives like, we really want you to have at least two children with so bonuses, tax incentives. What they found is China already probably would have had a falling birth rate because it was advancing economically. This happens to all developing, countries. And right now there's sort of a demographic time bomb because there's an elderly population and, a population, the birth rate is not sort of keeping up pace to help support, the elderly. So it'll be interesting to see if it kind of, we had a couple decades where China was coercing women to only, families to only have one child. And now it's like, are they going to try and coerce the other direction? So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, the other issue, as I understand it, is the other kind of time bomb is that young men far outnumber young women.
Right, right. Either the women, they were either aborted or some of them, and this is how this policy touches U.S. shores, like they, Chinese baby girls were put up abroad for adoption. So because of the culture's traditional preference for boys coupled with the one-child policy, that led to these unforeseen consequences.
How serious do you think that is, that imbalance?
Well, I mean, the Chinese government is trying to rectify it. And I mean, there are, there have been, I don't know, like some, and again, I don't know if this isn't widespread, but it like has certainly happened where maybe there might be, kidnap brides or, Chinese men might marry women from other neighboring countries. But of course there's like a whole cultural language barrier. We'll just have to see what happens. Like in some ways, China is like so advanced. Like the skyscrapers are like hot, like so tall, and the subway system is like a dream. But in other ways, there's like still deep, poverty. You exit this, you leave the city and drive for an hour, and people are still farming by hand. Like they don't even have an ox. So China's resources are. Part of China's strength is its vast numbers, but that's also what China has to sort of figure out how to manage, like this huge population, and how do you address the inequalities and go from there.
Mm. I was wondering about the use of surrogates for people to use too, if they I don't know, that gets into a whole other thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think, there were, when the one child policy was in effect, I think, There were some cases of people going abroad, for example, to get IVF so that they could come back with two babies, you know, or give birth and have two babies. But yeah, it's as with, you know, I think, you know, all eyes are on China, just as, you know, all eyes are on the U.S. in terms of like what the future will hold.
So, mm-hmm. Vanessa, you write a lot about immigrant issues as a journalist, and also, you know, your book is, you know, that's sort of what it's the basis of it. Are you from an immigrant family yourself?
Yeah, I'm the American-born daughter of Chinese immigrants. My parents came to this country in the 1960s to attend grad school. My mom's a scientist. My dad was an engineer. And so I've always been interested in trying to understand, you know, what it means to leave your country, your culture, your language, and to try and forge a new life, you know, and be a stranger in a strange land. And but I mean, I think people who are, say, not as recently immigrated still find the book resonates with them because it, you know, like any, like being an outsider, motherhood, you know, trying to make your way in the world, those are universal, right? Whether you're an immigrant or not. And I think it's, you know, when you show the sort of humanity of people's stories, you know, whether in journalism or in fiction, that's, you know, that's how you can sort of make a connection with the reader.
How do you think it has changed for immigrants from China today, like your character Scarlett Chen, versus when your parents came over? Is it very similar, or is it different?
I mean, it's certainly there's greater numbers, because my parents actually arrived, you know, as in a special category as foreign students, you know, on fellowships issued by the university, you know, and it was before the 1965 Immigration Act, which totally reshaped immigration in this country. So, you know, there weren't so, you know, so many, there wasn't as much Chinese immigration in, like when my parents first arrived. And now, because the Immigration Act allows for things like sponsorship of family and family reunification, that has led to, you know, not just China, you know, my parents never lived in Chinatown, but, you know, there's some, you know, I grew up in the suburbs. There's many more Chinese living, you know, everywhere, not just in sort of one neighborhood. And, I mean, certainly there were, you know, China, my parents came from Taiwan, which had relations with the U.S., whereas China itself was closed until sort of Nixon, you know, ping pong diplomacy and all that. So sort of like both the numbers and sort of where people are coming from, what, you know, before there were many more Cantonese speakers and now there's many more Mandarin speakers. So it's just, I think what we really are seeing is how, the Chinese community is not a monolith, and that we have these very diverse histories, occupations, you know, and I think, I hope that's reflected in A River of Stars. You know, we have both, you know, feisty entrepreneurs and, you know, scoundrels that actually, you know, have a heart of gold kind of thing going on.
Mm. Yeah. Well, there's definitely some interesting characters. And, this one, Mama Fang, is that her name?
Yes.
Yeah. She goes from one thing to another. She's unstoppable. One thing fails, she just gets into another one, doesn't she?
Yeah. And she's kind of inspired by a couple of things. Is in classic Chinese literature, you know, the sort of books where there's bandits and heroes and you wrestle with tigers, often there's an elderly woman who's a matchmaker, who sort of brokers deals, like whether they're marriages or affairs, and she always, you know, knows how to take a cut for herself. And so, you know, there's sort of a wiliness that I, you know, kind of couldn't help but admire. And yet in some ways there's sort of like modern analogs where, for example, there was a woman in China who realized that all the cardboard packaging in the U.S. that sort of like off of our Amazon delivery was actually very good quality. So she had it sort of shipped back to China and reused and recycled. And, you know, she saw treasure where there was trash and, you know, became wealthy as a result of being able to see possibility where others could not. And sort of that's sort of embodied in the Mama Fang character.
Mm. Well, she is an interesting character for sure. And, of course, Scarlet and Daisy. Daisy is another one that's very interesting. And
Oh, thank you. Yeah, she's, I mean, I thought a lot about, so Daisy is a pregnant teenager, and what's sort of, you know, in her character, I was able to explore a lot of different issues that I found interesting. She herself was born in the U.S. back when her parents were grad students, but then she grew up in Taiwan, but yet she went to an American school. So she, you know, has perfect English and, you know, she's familiar with all the references, you know, having grown up in this oasis of American culture in another country. And I was just really interested in exploring those notions of identity and citizenship and, you know, and also, I think she and Scarlet may seem different at first. Scarlet's from the countryside, from a very poor family. Daisy's, from, you know, some privilege. And yet I think they find, a kinship both in their, you know, motherhood because they both give birth within weeks of each other and because they, you know, in all that misery and exhaustion of early childhood, they kind of help each other through it. And I think it's sort of like living through a war or a natural disaster together.
Mm-hmm.
If you can survive early motherhood
with
someone else, you're going to make a friend for life. So.
Well, they also survivors of their environment.
Yes.
And, you know, the whole thing. I mean, they really, and they, I don't know, they kind of bounce off one another.
Right.
Yeah. You know, Scarlet gets upset with Daisy because of Daisy's outspokenness, but then she realizes, yeah, that's probably okay, and, you know, it just goes back and forth, so. But this book is one that you, well, you can't put it down.
Oh, thank you.
You want to find out what happens.
That's true, and it gets off to a fast start, and
yeah.
It's very intriguing.
It is.
Now, Vanessa, did you have to do a lot of research for this book?
Well, I think it draws upon my 2 decades as a reporter covering Asian Americans and also going to Asia. I've reported from China and sort of looked at the connections back and forth. But I also, you know, have been back to China on reporting trips. So I've had a sense of, you know, what the life for these factory girls is like. And then I also, you know, I read news reports about these maternity centers. I went to their websites. I also looked at some court documents. But what I believe is fiction flourishes where the official record ends. So, you know, when the women in these situations, when they were reported upon in the media, they obviously weren't talking. And so I felt it was up to me as a fiction writer to be able to sort of like imagine what brought them here and what it meant for them.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you too about the genius centers.
Oh, the little genius, right?
Little genius. Is that for real? They really do that?
I think I was striving for something that often with that or other places in the book, like, to have to cut, sort of ride that line, like, could it be real? Well, so that was inspired by a couple things. There have been times in Asia where I've been ill, like I had the flu, and then they sort of, you know, offered, like a friend had the flu, but then like suddenly they were putting an IV in her. There was like sort of I think in some situations a greater willingness to like get hooked up to an IV. Or to use that as a treatment. And then I began hearing that it's actually sort of in vogue among like Hollywood types. Like if you're in Las Vegas, if you're feeling hungover, you can get hooked up to an IV with vitamins and get hydrated that way.
Uh-huh.
So you sort of have that. And then I did see a photo of, in China, of some kids or some teenagers allegedly studying for the most important test in the country, their college entrance exams. And it was this strange photo of all these teenagers hooked up to IV lines.
Oh, my.
And so sort of with all that, I thought, okay, this sort of inspired this idea for these little genius centers in the U.S. so, yeah, it's just sort of inspired by, but it's not, I mean, as far as I know, you know, they don't actually exist, but who knows, perhaps.
But they might soon.
Right, exactly. That is always really interesting when you're a fiction writer, or something that you've imagined, you later find out is coming true. It's almost like you predicted the future.
Well, I don't know. I must have read another book somewhere where the parents were very, just, you know, their children were just told, you know, you have to succeed and pushed to really do that. And,
Well, that's definitely a stereotype. We have, you know, the tiger moms.
Right.
Do you feel that, you know, is that a valid?
Well, I mean, I'm a journalist and writer. I'm not an engineer or doctor. So, and yeah. You know, as to the preference for boys traditionally in the culture in my family, my father has like always supported me and my ambition. So I think that's something I try to show, that like there may be this perception, you know, it applies to some but not all, and sort of like it's something that can definitely be explored more deeply in a book length work.
It's interesting that, you know, it's a generalization, a prejudice almost, but it's has a positive connotation, but it can still be damaging.
Right, especially since if it masks sort of the varying levels of poverty and opportunity available even within the Chinese community. So, you know, depending on your circumstances, it can be, you know, your outcomes are very different. And yet to claim like, oh, they're all doing great, can be harmful to those who are struggling.
I just saw a report that Asian Americans as a demographic have the widest income disparity of any demographic group in the U.S. Now,
yeah, well,
that's
it represents,
not just Chinese, that's all,
right,
all Asian. But
right, it represents, yeah, a huge range of ethnicities, cultures.
Right.
You know, depends on if you came in as a refugee or an immigrant, or, you know, just, you know, if you were fleeing or coming here for opportunity. so it is hard to generalize. But, you know, in other ways, it's very interesting. Like, Asian Americans are the fastest growing ethnic group in the U.S. And it'll be interesting to kind of see what the future holds in terms of representation, whether in books or in movies. Of course, Crazy Rich Asians just came out, was the number one hit movie. So it'll be interesting to see what it opens the way for in the future.
Well, my granddaughter is Asian American, and my grandchildren, their mother's was born in Taiwan,
mm-hmm,
and she, at 5 years old, she's really interested in numbers. She asked me what the largest number was. I said I didn't know, but I knew that Google was pretty large. And then she wanted to actually see that number written out.
Right.
Oh my god.
Well, yeah. One of my twins loves storytelling. He loves doing things with little, you know, minifigs or dolls, or like asking what their name is and like doing play acting. And my other son, he loves math. He loves multiplication even more than addition, because you get bigger numbers with multiplication.
Yeah.
How old are they?
They just turned 7, and they just started the second grade.
Oh, that's such a wonderful age.
Yes,
they're still cute and cuddly, but yet you can have real conversations with them.
Exactly. I know my grandson just will be 9 in a couple of months, and on this last time I saw him, I noticed that when he's walking, that he's not walking like a little kid anymore. He's got a little bit of a young man kind of swagger going on.
Oh.
But he can still be cute and cuddly.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I think my heart will
crack open when they completely stop wanting to hold my hand.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, Vanessa, would you like to read from A River of Stars?
Sure, I'd love to. I'll read an excerpt taken from Chapter 1.
Great.
A River of Stars, Chapter 1. When Boss Jung first told her about Perfume Bay, she tossed the brochure onto the dashboard and reached for a slice of dried mango. Shaking his head, he took the bag, but before he could stop her, she snatched a slice of chewy sweetness. During her pregnancy, he'd begun scrutinizing her, prescribing advice, some backed by science, but most by superstition, to protect the baby. She shouldn't eat mangoes, as her heat would give the baby bad skin. No watermelon, whose chill would cool her womb. No bananas, which would cause the baby to slip out early. No water chestnuts, mung beans, or bean sprouts, either. The list of traditional prohibitions grew each time she attempted to eat. As he drifted into the next lane, she told him to keep his eyes on the road. He gripped the steering wheel and told her his plan. He wanted to send her and their unborn child halfway around the world to Perfume Bay, five-star accommodations located outside of Los Angeles. After she delivered, staff would file for a Social Security card, birth certificate, and passport for the baby. Their son, his sex recently confirmed, would give them a foothold in America, he said. Eventually, he could sponsor a green card, Scarlett had said. For now, you'll get rid of me. Clever plan, Boss Jung. At the factory, she called him Boss Jung, and she kept it up in private, too, a reminder that she was a deputy manager and not a xiaojie, a mistress, a gold digger from a disco or a hostess bar. They passed factories covered in grimy white tile, built on land that had been fields when she arrived here as a teenager. People from around the country had moved to the Pearl River Delta, just across the border from Hong Kong, to make their fortunes, and the factory girl you snubbed might someday become your manager. Boss Jung reached into the glove box for a brand new U.S. atlas that he must have hand-carried from Hong Kong. Hope unfurled in her chest. She always navigated on their weekend drives, and with this gift, she pictured them traveling across America together. Whatever hospital you deliver in would be top class, he said. The hospitals are good in Hong Kong, too, she said. Boss Jung frowned. Hong Kong was also home to his wife and three daughters. It doesn't matter how good the hospitals are in America if I end up in jail, she said. On the radio, a newscaster announced that the U.S. Embassy was evacuating American tourists from Egypt. Boss Jung stabbed his finger at the radio dial. The U.S. would save our son, he said. From Egypt? Why would he go to Egypt, she said. From anywhere, he said. The U.S. would get him out of trouble anywhere. That was when Scarlett had realized just how much his son meant to Boss Jung, reviving the dream that had died with the birth of his daughters, an heir to carry on his legacy. He had never shared this dream with her, for a boy in his image, a prince of the family. He was almost 60, she was 36. If Scarlett carried a girl, would Boss Jung have sent her to Perfume Bay? No. He'd waited to book her a stay until he knew she was having a boy, but objecting to such a preference would have been like objecting to gravity. He sped up, picking off tractor trailers and buses, which still gave her a thrill. Faster and faster they went, getting so far ahead it seemed they might have the road's end to themselves. With him behind the wheel, she might go anywhere. He put his hand on top of hers, lacing their fingers together, and she tucked her head against his shoulder. She'd never felt more complete than when nestled against him. If she didn't have this baby, she might never, not with Boss Jung or with anyone else. On her own, Scarlett could have expected deference and attention. One pregnant woman gets a seat on the bus, the front of the line at the bathroom, and good wishes from strangers who pat your bump, ask how far along you are, and guess if you're carrying a boy or a girl. At the sight of a fertile belly, the most hardened can't help but hope for the future, can't help but long for the past. A dozen pregnant women is a different matter. You quarrel over who gets the most comfortable seat at dinner, who eats the last of the tofu stew, and whose aches are the most deserving of sympathy. Now, deep in her eighth month of pregnancy, she'd thought the other guests at Perfume Bay would lose interest, but they wouldn't stop picking on her. On television, the Hollywood sign appeared, iconic letters that stood a few kilometers away, yet seemed distant as the moon. After Scarlett turned up the volume, Lady Yu grabbed the remote and switched the channel. Because Scarlett had never bragged about Boss Jung's position, because she never mentioned him at all, the other guests found her suspect. She was a threat, not because she'd go after their husbands, but because she represented any woman, every woman who would. it didn't matter that her lover was a stranger to them. Mistresses weren't supposed to have children who competed with theirs. Lady Yu had made it clear she considered Scarlet and the baby she carried lowlies, turtle's eggs. Nothing was more despicable than a turtle dragging itself through the muck, except their spawn. Lady Yu led the Shanghai clique of spoiled wives, who were perhaps only a generation or two removed from the countryside. In Scarlet, they despised who they might have been. Scarlet changed the channel back. Mao Wenhua, Nong Ming, Lady Yu shouted. Low class, a peasant. She hurled a magazine at Scarlet, missing wildly and hitting the television. Tuhao, Scarlet said, an insult for the newly rich with more money than manners. Lady Yu heaved herself up and slapped Scarlet. Scarlet rocked back in disbelief, putting up her hands to protect the baby. Lady Yu smiled smugly. Scarlet grabbed a pillow and smacked it against Lady Yu's head. When Lady Yu clawed at her, Scarlet grabbed her wrists and forced her arm down, twisting almost hard enough to sprain. Their screams set off one baby, then all 10 babies in the nursery next door, howls that picked up with the speed and power of a tsunami. The owner, Mama Fang, rushed in, trailed by nurses to separate the mothers-to-be, clucking that they shouldn't exert themselves. They should consider their babies and sent them to their room. At Perfume Bay, the mothers were treated like children, said that their children would obtain the most precious gift of all, American citizenship.
And that was Vanessa Wall reading from A River of Stars. Vanessa,
so Scarlet.
Go ahead.
Scarlet faces quite a bit of abuse in that home because they figure she's not that she's not of the class that they are, the other women. Is that right?
Right. She's surrounded by sort of the pampered wives, and you know they're suspicious of her. You know, they speak a different sort of like their native dialect is different, and just she's viewed with much suspicion, and so she feels like a virtual prisoner when she's there. And this is sort of building toward why she feels like she does need to make an escape.
And it wasn't really her choice to be there in the first place.
Right, as in the passage I read, her lover, you know, convinced her to do it. And it's only after another sonogram reveals something, and only after her lover betrays her that she realizes she has to take off. And with a pregnant teenage stowaway, Daisy, in tow. And I've been telling people that it's a pregnant Thelma and Louise tale.
That's right.
Perfect. Now, when you started writing this, you knew you were going to write about these maternity centers, maternity hotels. But did you know the rest of the story, or how did that unfold for you?
Yeah, with my fiction, often it begins with a premise or a circumstance or situation, and I try and figure out what kind of person would find themselves in this situation. You know, how did they get there, and how are they going to get out of it? And so once I had heard about the maternity centers, and there was one particular news story where a neighbor said that a pregnant Chinese woman showed up on his doorstep and said she was hungry. And so he took her to McDonald's. He got her a burger, and then she, you know, took her right back to the maternity hotel. And, you know, I think she probably didn't get to eat what she wanted, you know, had no real freedom. And it kind of made me realize, like, what, you know, what would it be like? And, you know, for dramatic effect, like, what, you know, it can't be just someone who's like sort of unhappy about the cuisine, but it has to be someone who feels like things are at stake, like, you know, being with your child and, you know, reproductive freedom and all that. And so that's how the character of Scarlet began to develop. And then at first Daisy was just, you know, a fun, feisty, minor character in one of the scenes, when it was a short story, and it sort of ended with Scarlet taking off. But as, you know, I couldn't sort of let that short story go, and it sort of felt like it was still expanding in my imagination. And that's when Daisy returned, and then the novel became not just about motherhood, but about female friendship and sort of what develops between Scarlet and Daisy. And it's, I mean, I think that's sort of the fun and challenge of fiction, that you start with a blank page that feels big as the world in terms of all the possibilities. But then as you go along and get to know your character and you sort of see what you've laid down in this world, you know, you begin to see where they have to go, and that you are, you always hope for that sweet spot of, like, you know, being that feeling of surprise, but inevitability that, like, this is what you've been building towards.
The Asian American culture particularly in San Francisco was interesting, I thought, because they're not all pulling in the same direction. And,
exactly.
It was really interesting to see how she survived and, you know, flourished in that culture. It was really interesting.
Thank you. Yeah. Scarlett, becomes an entrepreneur, as, you know, some immigrants choose to do so because they sort of like can't work sort of like formally, like in an office, or, you know, like what kind of jobs in general open to new mothers. But for something where she could set her own hours and sort of like determine her own way. And I mean, San Francisco's Chinatown is just such a remarkable place. It's, you know, got this long history. It's the oldest Chinatown in the U.S. And yet you go and visit and there's a throbbing sense of vitality because of the newcomers who continue to arrive in the neighborhood, which serves as a landing pad, a jumping off point into their life here. And yet it also, Chinatown draws a lot of visitors, you know, with their cameras out, going to the shops, going to the restaurants. But that's, so most people's, you know, most people's public view of Chinatown is on the ground floor, right? Street level.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look up, you look on the second floor, the third floor, fourth floor, you see clothes hanging, to dry in the window, laundry. And then you realize, oh, people live here. This is a living, breathing neighborhood. And, you know, with very interesting, you know, people have very interesting stories to tell. And, it's, you know, as a journalist, I had an opportunity to kind of go visit into that world upstairs, and I wanted to, you know, capture that in my book.
When Vanessa, or excuse me, when, Scarlett and Daisy first got to Chinatown, they weren't welcomed very warmly.
Right. They had to figure out the rules of, mm-hmm. and customs, and like who sort of the people who might be their guide, who to be wary of, you know. And so like any place, there's bound to be conflict. And it's sort of it's like about, yeah, even within, you might say like, oh, you're like, just go to Chinatown. Like, it's sort of like there's, you still have to, you know, find your own way, since, because the community is not all alike, you know, not all speaking the same dialect, not all from the same place. And so, it's about, you know, trying to negotiate your way there.
Now, how do you feel when you go there?
Well, I know, I mean, I'm not a Chinatown native. I grew up in the suburbs, but
right.
Yet I feel enormous sense of familiarity and comfort in some ways, even, you know, even stepping into a store and sort of like seeing the candies I ate as a kid, or just like the, you know, familiar pungent smell of like dried fish. It just feels like it really hits the olfactory memories. And I mean, I feel, just sort of inspired by people who are just trying to, you know, make a better life for their children or for themselves. And you can really sense that when you're there.
So you feel at home, and you feel
or
accepted.
I feel, it feels a sense of familiarity and comfort. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the culture in Chinatown and San Francisco is probably different than the culture of a country that a new immigrant would be coming from, too.
Exactly. Because, for example, I remember interviewing people in Chinatown, and, you know, these apartment buildings are often communal kitchen, or shared bathrooms, like cramped, whole families living in these cramped spaces. And one of the women I talked to said that her place in China was actually nicer and newer than what she lived in Chinatown. So, but yet at the same time, the possibilities for education and work were better here. So they were willing to live in those conditions, because of, you know, the flip side of what the U.S. offered. So,
Do you think that the new immigrants have a realistic expectation of America?
I mean, China is, so I think the traditional name for, like sort of a, like a older name for China, for San Francisco is Gold Mountain, because, you know, Chinese, because of the Chinese immigrants who came, you know, during the gold rush, mm-hmm. it was seen as Golden Mountain, like a place of limitless opportunity. But of course, in that time, like, China itself has developed. So even a peasant will have a cell phone, probably even more advanced than the cell phones we might have, right, in some ways. And so they're not like naive. There's, you know, they see this, you know, they may have seen the skyscrapers or the Ferraris being driven by Chinese millionaires. So they know that such wealth, like, is possible even in China. And so, I mean, I can't speak for all Chinese immigrants, but I think, you know, often, whether they're Chinese or not, people from other countries are fearful of things like gun violence in this country, or just, you know, things that are different, or, you know, and in all the ways that we might stereotype another country, Americans are sort of stereotyped from abroad too. So it's sort of, I think, as a new immigrant, you're really trying to sort of like reconcile what you've heard about the country and what you're actually experiencing and living.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was in Canada last summer and mentioned that I live part-time in Texas and was greeted with like, oh, isn't it really scary there with all the guns?
Right.
Which it is a little, but but you don't see the guns very often.
Right. So it all like, China's a vast country, the U.S. is a vast country, and it's all about trying to sort of get past this sort of surface assumptions that people might make.
Right.
So Vanessa, yeah. When you, how long did you spend writing this book?
Well, let's see. So I was inspired when I was pregnant, but the sort of first draft I finished of the short story was about 9 months after I gave birth, which I thought was kind of a cool symmetry. And I certainly was writing other things, or attempting to write other things in that, you know, in those months as well. And so I started the short story, and then again was working on like another novel, other projects. But I started, let me put it this way. I started writing the sort of seed of it in 2012, and it sold in 2016. And then there was, you know, I went through additional edits with my editor. And so, you know, it's hard to say if I compressed the time, how long it would have been, because it's like sort of my life is not sort of like a neat trajectory of the book is not like sort of neatly cut through my life, because my life sort of pushed back on it.
Was it easier to get this novel published because you had published the short stories previously?
No, actually, they it all kind of happened around the same time. I found out I had won this contest that led to my short story collection being published, and like a couple, it was around that time that, you know, I finished edits with my agent and it was sent out. So like I think I announced the pub, I remember going on social media and like announcing my excitement at, you know, having my short story collection coming out. But then like a week later saying like, hey, do you remember how I just announced the short story collection? Well, now I have, you know, a 2-book novel deal. And people are like, oh, how did you, wow, you know, do that overnight? How did you get 3 books so quickly? I'm like, by working on my writing for like more than a decade. You know, no success is truly overnight. Well, maybe for some people, but not for me. So
so a lot of times you hear that finding an agent is really the hard part. Was that true for you?
I feel fortunate. I was able, you know, I'm actually now, I switched agents over time. And each time I was, you know, able to sort of pick among some. But, you know, it's still hard. There were, you know, there were as many agents who probably sort of passed on the project as, you know, those who wanted to take it on, you know, and right. I mean, I think the same goes for true as like when you put a manuscript out, even the most popular book out there probably was rejected by one editor or another in its journey. And I think it, because of all the sort of the long, long process it takes to put a book out, your agent or your editor really has to feel like they fell in love with the book. And so in some ways there's like no rhyme or reason. Like you could maybe guess like, oh, this person might have an affinity for my book, but like, you know, can you really say how you fell in love with your partner? Like, is it like a neat set of traits, you know, a checkbox, or is there something sort of, there has to be chemistry between you, you know, your book and whoever, you know, chooses to take it on.
So when you say you got a 2-book deal, so that was for this book and the one that you worked on in your master's program.
Exactly.
And yeah. Why yeah. was the decision made to bring this one out first?
Oh, this one was done first. So my master's, I mean, I have a draft of the book that I wrote in grad school, but it's the one that I wrote, you know, it's like historic. It's just, you know,
you're better now.
It's just a different challenge. Yeah. So, I mean, and I'm a different writer. I think even, from the start of one, you start writing the book, you're one writer. And by the end of it, you're another. And so, not that it becomes any easier.
But so, hopefully you're getting better all the time.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So, well, Vanessa, it was really a pleasure talking to you today, and we are out of time.
Oh, no.
No. But it was such a pleasure to...
Thing.
Yeah. Oh, go on.
There's one thing I wanted to bring up about the journey that Scarlett had to try to get her green card. And that's what so many immigrants are struggling in the United States to do. And I, you know, so this book really clearly shows what happens and how difficult it is. I think that's so important.
Exactly.
That's why this book is really, really important. And that's why I enjoyed it so much, because I had often wondered about that. And so this really lays it out and shows exactly what happens.
Oh, great. Well, I'm so glad that you found it both entertaining, but also educational in some way, too.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
And I think it's important to tell these stories.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
To be able to see people who maybe look different from me or you, Mom, but to see when you know their stories, then you know their humanity.
Right.
You can see their humanity.
Yeah. So, well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. And Mom,
thank you for writing this book.
Thank you.
And do you have some closing words for us, Mom?
Yes. You know who, I hope everyone knows who Mahatma Gandhi was, very, very wise man who once said, "We must be the change we want to see in the world." So it's up to us to change these things.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.